Do you think you'd never be targeted with disinformation? Well, remember hearing about those new Australian road rules? Curfews for drivers over 60 and mandates to keep your lights on. That was actually an AI disinformation campaign. G'day, it's Hamish McDonald here. I'm a journalist, and I've been learning that online tactics just like this are being used regularly to seed mistrust in government decision-making. You can join me as I interrogate the world of mis and disinformation. Stream The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hip-hop and rap helped save Nick Orchard's life. The music gave him something to focus on as a kid when his mum was struggling with her mental health. And later, it was a mainstay while Nick was having a tough time himself, drinking too much and without any regular place to live. But one day, just when things were at their worst, Nick got an unexpected helping hand. And that in turn led him to helping other people. Firstly, it was other young people who'd found themselves in situations like he'd been in. And he did that so well that he ended up with a big job in government that didn't end the way Nick planned. Today he's a coach for people who feel they're just hanging on by their fingernails but want to change that story. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
I'm really well. Let's start with music. Tell me, when did you fall in love with hip-hop?
Sure. I fell in love with hip-hop as a teenager. I came into high school and it was just everywhere amongst my friendship group. I loved, they were fairly obscure at the time, but I loved Busta Rhymes. I absolutely loved Cypress Hill, who were a hip-hop group. There was something so cool and edgy and so different from all the other music that was proliferating the pop charts, and I just loved it. My best friend Matt was totally obsessed with hip-hop as well. And so I started writing my little raps, and he was a graffiti artist, this amazing graffiti artist. And so we felt like we were kind of together against the system in there. Like, I was making my music and he was doing his raps, and it felt really cool and rebellious, and like we were just, I don't know, part of something together.
Your first rap performance happened at a high school talent show.
Certainly.
Nick, how did that go down?
Oh, it was just shocking. So I'd always been writing raps and like rapping them out loud in my bedroom or rapping them to my friend Matt. And I was like, yeah, like I'm crushing it. These are so good. And there was this high school talent show coming up. I just went and told everyone in the whole school. I was like, yeah, I'm going to come and do this rap performance. It's going to be awesome. And, you know, I was talking a big game and people were really behind me. And they showed up and I didn't even rehearse this thing before I got up. And it was like this beat that was on an old cassette that I got them to play for me. And it was way too fast to even rap over. I don't know what I was thinking. And I got up in front of these people and experienced stage fright for the first time in my life. And my knees were shaking so hard, they were literally knocking together. I was holding the microphone with both hands and still shaking so violently, it hit me in the teeth a few times and just struggled through a few verses, totally off beat. And there was stone cold silence at the end of it.
That's a hard show to come back from.
Oh, it was rough.
That's hard. How old were you at that point?
I think I was 16 or 17. It was a rough entry point.
So this is when you were living in Melbourne, but whereabouts did you start life? Where were you a little kid?
So when I was very young, I think I was maybe 6 months old, my parents moved to Ararat, which is a small rural town in Victoria. And the really cool thing about Ararat is that your backyard is the Grampians, and it's just magnificent, this beautiful mountain range, beautiful bushland, just totally gorgeous. But Ararat itself is, pretty, there's not heaps going on in Ararat. So it was a bit of a funny place to grow up. I remember spending lots of time alone or with my mum and my dad, lots of time playing with action figures by myself in my bedroom. But yeah, I remember spending lots of time kind of in my head and in my imagination, which was kind of fine because I was a pretty imaginative kid.
What were your mum and dad doing for work when the family were living there?
So Dad had become a teacher, I think not because he really wanted to become a teacher, but just because it was a gig and they were having a baby. And so he'd done his dip ed. And at the time, through placement, the only spot he could get was in Ararat. They had lived in Melbourne. And so they moved to Ararat, and Dad was a maths teacher in the local high school, and I think in the local tech, as they had in those days as well. And Mum was a midwife at the local hospital.
And what were things like between them? How do you remember their relationship?
I remember them as just being the most extraordinarily different people. So my mum is the most charismatic and magnetic person in any room you could ever walk into. She is pure colour in all the ways at all the times, all singing, all dancing, big, big, big personality. And Dad is much more quiet and introverted, and he's a real thinker. He's always thinking about things really deeply and worries about world issues. So I remember them being just totally yin and yang as I was growing up.
And how did you find out that they were going to be separating?
I remember my mum taking me on a walk at one point and sort of telling me, but not being particularly surprised, because they had been living in separate bedrooms in the house for quite a while. And I remember actually Dad, because he was in kind of like this single bed in the spare room, he was reading The Power of One at the time, and every day would kind of give me a lowdown of what he'd read the night before. And I remember that really fondly. But the thing that struck me more was that we were moving back to Melbourne. And that felt really big and scary, because my whole life was here with my friends. I was 8 years old.
So that was you and your mum moving together to Melbourne?
Yeah, that's right.
And how was she doing in those years, Nick?
So it's a little harder to gauge how she was doing during that time, because I wasn't super aware of what might have been going on for her. But for someone who is so big and colourful and like engaged in community theatre and this huge personality, for all that colour, sometimes Mum would become very black and white for a while, and it was usually preceded by having a migraine, and then she would just be, all that colour would kind of drain out of her, and it was almost like she wasn't there anymore for a while.
Was that scary for you, or how do you remember feeling when that would happen?
It was really scary, and I just wanted it to come back. You know, she was my best mate, and I just wanted to be able to help her get that colour back in those times, however I could.
Would she talk with you about, you know, how she was thinking, what was going on inside and mentally, emotionally, when she would go into those kind of states?
I remember when I was much younger, you know, she would say, I'm feeling a bit sad, or I'm feeling like I have, you know, my head's a bit busy. But when I got older, she was much more explicit. So when I was a teenager, I remember Mum had just been through a really rough breakup, and she was doing it really hard. And we went for a walk. We were walking down Brunswick Street, where we spent a lot of time, you know, this bright, kind of colourful space. And she just looked shocking. And I think I said something to her along the lines of, you know, like, it's going to be okay. Like, it's just you and me. And she said, I'm just thinking about cutting my wrists. And it just totally rocked me to my core. And I didn't even know how to respond. So it just brought on this fear of, like, you know, this is my best mate, you know.
Was there anyone that you could talk to about hearing things like that from your mum?
I didn't talk to anyone at the time about it. I did much later in secondary school, in year 12, had this amazing teacher who, in kind of an unlikely fashion, became someone I could talk to really openly about these things. And he became this really amazing mentor for me. And I would sometimes talk to Dad, but I didn't want to tell Dad everything that was going on either.
You had a visit from, or your mum had a visit from, the police one day. What do you remember about that?
Yeah, and it had been preceded by, we'd moved to Maribyrnong, and we'd moved to this, like, quite big sort of apartment out there. But at the same time, Mum had stepped into a kind of local childcare role that I imagine wasn't paying super well. I remember Dad coming out, because he helped me move some stuff out there, and looking around and saying to me, how are you affording this? I was like, I don't know. I don't think about it. Like, I guess we just are. And could hear Mum having conversations with friends around kind of trying to borrow money, or kind of money-related conversations. And she just seemed increasingly in a pretty bad place. And then one day there was a knock at the door and I went to the door and opened it and it was the police at the door. And my immediate assumption was our neighbours were always having police going over. So I was like, oh, you got the wrong place. Like, it's like across the hall, go talk to them. And they asked for mum. And I invited them in and mum was upstairs and I went and told her and she was getting dressed and I made them a cup of tea and I had a cup of tea and then they took mum off for a while. And I just sat around. I didn't know what to do. I literally just sat and kind of stared at the TV, not taking anything in, just so confused. And she came back a few hours later, just kind of ashen-faced. And I made her a cup of tea when she got home and gave it to her. And I remember she kind of had a sip of it. Her hands were really shaky. And she told me it was a bit yuck because I hadn't put sugar in it. So I went and put some sugar in it. And she was telling me about this interview room she had been in and that it was really horrible. And a couple of days later, she checked herself into Melbourne Clinic, which is a psychiatric facility, a private facility in Melbourne.
And can you tell me why the police were there or what had happened?
I still don't really know.
Did she give you the details of that?
No. And, you know, I think there was some, so nothing ever came of whatever that was about, but it seemed really clear that she was not in a good way and she... Yeah, then, and I was just heading into year 12 exams at the time. I was heading into my 18th birthday, and she had to spend this time in this facility. And I remember just not understanding and not knowing what I could do about it. Like, I wanted to help, but I didn't know how.
While this was going on at home, you were getting more involved with your music and trying to get into hip hop in new ways. How did your experience of competing in a hip-hop battle compare with your talent school experience? I hope it went better.
It did go better. It did go better. So hip-hop battles used to be held in Melbourne. Like, it was so on the nose to have a hip-hop show because the toilets would get absolutely bombed with graffiti. Like, there would always be a fight breakout. It was just chaos. So very few venues would have it. But the first one I went to was at a place called Cherry Bar in Melbourne, like a rock and roll kind of venue, but they held it during the day. It was an underage hip-hop battle called Run Amok. And I walked in there and it was just full of all these like really sketchy looking young men. I probably look sketchy as well. All just kind of standing like kind of mouthing to themselves, practicing their little freestyles. And I was really nervous there as well, but I was there with Matt and got up. And I remember this feeling of, I had this kind of punchline, because essentially rap battles, you just insult your partner who you're up against in rhyme.
So on stage together?
On stage. And you just diss each other in rhymes. And I had this line, it was pretty much exclusively your mum jokes is what was going on, but I had this line and everyone really cheered when I said this line. I was like, oh my God, this is the greatest feeling in the world.
So it felt like this was, I don't know, it felt like a home in a way, that environment for you or what?
It felt like a community. And I had never felt part of a community before. And I remember getting off stage and Matt just grabbing my face and going, that was awesome. And we were just like, yes, like we found our tribe.
So as you were finding your place in this scene, Nick, your mum was still not doing great. And you got a call one night when you were out on a date.
Yeah, it was actually one morning. I was out on
a brunch date.
Yeah,
oh, a brunch date. Okay.
Brunch date. It was with this young woman who looked exactly like Natalie Imbruglia. I was like, oh my God, she's like so far out of my league. And she was like very clean and scrubbed, which was like the antithesis of what I was at the time. And when I say brunch, it was probably like 2 p.m, you know, like that was brunch time at the time. And I had made the extraordinarily poor choice of ordering a kind of bagel dish that had hollandaise on it. And so I was like wearing half the hollandaise and I was super nervous and just messing up my words. And anyway, got a call and which I made sure to answer because I had no phone credit ever at the time, but I got it because it was from my mum's best friend. And I remember taking this call and the first thing she said is, it's all right, your mum's okay. I was so confused because like, you know, why is she okay? And she just kept repeating, it's okay, she's okay. But you should probably come. We've just been in the hospital, but we're going to the Melbourne Clinic where she had been previously. And you might want to come and meet her there. And I remember asking what's happened. And I don't even remember how her best friend responded to me or how she explained what had happened. But it just kind of suddenly dawned on me. I hung up and the young woman I was with was like, oh, you know, what was that? And I think I looked like a ghost probably. And I just said, my mum's tried to kill herself. and I need to go and see her. And so immediately we kind of left this date, and this young woman drove me to the Melbourne Clinic. I remember it was so strange saying goodbye to her. I was like, you know, oh, like I've just been in this place that, and now I'm going into this other world. And it really, I really went pretty off the rails after that for a while.
Tell me first about your mum. She recovered from that attempt in her life and left the clinic. Where did she go then? Was she getting the support that she obviously needed?
Yeah, she did have support, like quite good mental health support after that point, but she also was living, it was kind of a strange arrangement, but she was living in a makeshift apartment that was essentially kind of like a shed or a garage at the back of an ex-boyfriend's house. But it meant that she didn't have to pay rent and she had somewhere to go. And so she was kind of holed up there for a while after she got out of the hospital. I think she was in for 4 or 5 weeks, but once she got out, she had a place to go.
What about you, though, Nick? I mean, what was happening in your life while your mum was in this pretty bad way?
I was, you know, really drinking a lot and had found myself in a scenario where I was couch surfing.
So where were you living? Yeah, tell me about that.
A friend of mine, his mum had gone overseas for a while, so I'd been living with him for a bit, and then she had come back. And I, my little brother had just been born, and so I went to stay at Dad's place for a while. But
this was your dad's new partner,
yeah.
Their son. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. And so I couldn't live in Dad's house because there was no space. They had a new baby in there. But they set up this tent for me in the backyard for a while. It was like Dad's old 70s burnt orange kind of teepee tent that I called Aladdin's Love Nest, like in the backyard there. It was just this like total eyesore stank of like old canvas. But so I lived in the tent for a little while, but I went out for a few days. I had a show and didn't come back. And then when I came back out there, the tent was gone. And so I think I had, you know, kind of neglected to be out there for a while, and they sort of assumed I wasn't coming back. And I kind of took that as a sign I should go elsewhere.
And how old were you at this point, Nick?
I would have been 21, I think. Yeah.
And you say you were drinking a lot. Was that an everyday kind of thing at that point?
Yeah, it was an everyday and really heavily thing. And because my whole life was running hip-hop nights and going to shows, it was a really heavy drinking culture. And so it was pretty easy to mask that I was drinking a lot. And I was a very high-functioning alcoholic, essentially. And so I was able to hide it. And actually, it was kind of through drinking that I would find places to stay, because once my options had kind of dried up of places to be and I had no money, I was really broke at the time, I would wander up and down Brunswick Street and just look for people I knew, because most of my life was spent on Brunswick Street, and go and stay on their couch or, you know, in a spare bed.
That sounds like a pretty, pretty scary way to live. Were you aware of it at the time, or you were just kind of in the flow of this is what life's like?
I was not even remotely aware of it. I don't think I would even, I'm sure I wouldn't even have conceptualized it as, you know, being homeless or even couch surfing. It was just like, well, this is what I'm doing. It's all good. I was just living day to day. And because I was drinking a lot, it was just kind of in the flow of, you know, just existing.
You did end up making contact with a homelessness support organisation called Home Ground when it looked like all the other options had kind of been used up. What did that caseworker suggest? Where did she suggest you go?
I did. I'd been referred by a friend's brother to go and talk to Home Ground, because he heard about what was going on, and he was like, man, like, you're homeless. Like, you actually don't have anywhere to be. Like, just, there are agencies for this. Like, go and talk to them. And I went in to and met with my caseworker, who was like the antithesis of what I was expecting. I was thinking it was going to be, you know, someone kind of streetwise sort of, and it was just this very scrubbed sort of person. And she chatted to me about my circumstances and said, look, the only referral I can give you for someone to go tonight is going to be the Gatwick. And the Gatwick was this like really notorious homelessness facility or kind of housing spot on Victoria Street in St Kilda. And she said, I encourage you, beyond anything else, whatever trigger you need to pull, wherever else you can go, don't go there. Like, I'll give you the referral and you can go there if you want, go down and check it out, but whatever other options you've got, take them. And so I wandered down Victoria Street to check it out. And I was so scared. Like, I was really scared. And I was like, this isn't real. Like, this isn't happening.
What did it look like when you arrived at the Gatwick?
So I stood from across the road and looked at it. There was like a 7-Eleven across the road. I stood from the 7-Eleven and looked, and there was just this congregation of people out the front, and like there was some aggressive stuff going on, and there were people kind of having a verbal argument. And it felt so terrifying to me to like walk over there and walk through. But also, like, at the time, I was pretty isolated because I had no credit on my phone. I never had credit to kind of call people. I didn't have a car. I was on public transport and didn't have money for a ticket either. So I was running away from tram officers all the time. And so I was really feeling stuck. I was like, do I walk across the road and go in there or do I not? And I went for a walk to think about it and had a phone call come in. And it was this number that, like, I'd had heaps of missed calls from this number over the previous few weeks, but it was one I didn't know and I hadn't caught it. And I answered it. It was this guy called John Favaro. And John was calling to offer me a job.
Did you know who he was? Had you heard of him before?
I had no idea who John was, and you could have knocked me over with a feather when I found out he was semi-famous later. But he was one of the very few people on earth who had seen my, like, very bad rapping live and thought it was kind of okay, but also had been referred to me by someone who had suggested I would make a good youth mentor for young men who were going through some things. And he was calling to offer me a job mentoring young men who were at risk of contact with the justice system or who might have been in contact with the justice system.
And so how did you respond? I mean, I'm thinking of you on this day where you're debating whether or not to enter this pretty scary looking boarding house. You get a phone call from a stranger offering you a job. How did you react?
Like, I've never been shy of a chat, and so just it was like verbal diarrhea. I just spilled. I'm like, oh man, like, I'm in this really hard scenario. Like, that sounds awesome, but like, this what's going on? And I just spilled to this person who I don't know. He's just a name on the other end of the phone, and he was so calm and he was so chill. And you know, this was his work, so it's not surprising. But he was like, it's all right, man. Like, I'll just advance you some of the money, and you just go and get yourself sorted. And come in on Monday, and let's just start this work.
Like, really? So he gave you some cash straight away?
Yeah, straight away. And it was just enough for me to get set up. I went and lived in a friend's. A friend was in a share house that had a spare room. And that was it. Like, I never looked back after that. It was the start of my career.
So you never had to go and stay at the Gatwick?
No.
You managed with that phone call to find a place that worked better for you. I mean, that must feel like a real sliding doors moment, that phone call.
Such a sliding doors moment. And I've seen John many, many times over the years. And he's just like so sick of me banging on about it as well. But, you know, like, I really feel like who knows what would have happened after that point. But gosh, things just went in such a fantastic direction after that.
You say you didn't realise that he was semi-famous. What do you mean?
So John was the bass player in The Bad Loves, who was quite a famous Australian band and, you know, really highly renowned and really known in the music scene. But
not for hip-hop.
Not for hip-hop. But actually, like, he had started this incredible program, or was part of this program for a non-profit called Living Music, where they were using hip-hop as the tool of engagement for young men who were at risk to be able to tell their stories and engage in something.
So that was the job that he was ringing to offer you to work with. What was it like when you turned up for your first day of work? I mean, it's interesting. It's like you're in the position needing support, but your job was to give support to other men. How does that work from a mentor perspective?
You know, as I have grown up in the sector, really, I just think more and more peer approaches are what works. I think people are so much more willing to link in with someone who might be just one step ahead of them on a pathway, maybe. And I remember turning up on the first day, really not knowing what to expect, and walking in, and it was just this cool music studio with these like amazing mixing desks everywhere, and it was pretty thrashed, you know, like everything was very pre-loved and used, but it was so amazing. And meeting these two young men who were two young men that a friend of mine and I were mentoring, and they were just like us. They were just like these really cool guys with like great hip-hop skills and great talent, and had certainly been through hard times, but had these amazing stories to tell. And the deal with the program was, I think it was like every fortnight we were meant to meet up with these guys. But Joel, my friend, and I, we were like, no, we've got like access to a studio. Let's just hang out all the time. And we were in there like a few times a week just writing more songs and trying to write an album. And it was the best. It was amazing.
Out of this work that you started doing, Nick, you then got a job going up through the Torres Strait to work with communities up there. What was that like?
It was so cool. So I had the great privilege of working in remote communities all over Australia. And it was this funny kind of ragtag group. So it was me who was teaching rapping, but a whole group of breakdancers as well. And wherever we went, it was just like the hip-hop circus is coming to town. You know, we were just going to stagger in and do some cool raps, or they would do some backflips or whatever and get involved in the community. But it was sponsored by Beyond Blue. And really, it was about using kind of hip hop as a tool of engagement, but a way to tell stories, to tackle some of the issues, the kind of prevalence of youth suicide, really, and some of the mental health challenges occurring in community. And but this one island, Boigu, in the Torres Strait, it's the single most beautiful place I've ever been. So you've got to get there. You go to Thursday Island first, and then you get on like this tiny little seaplane and go out there. Like, we're in this four-seater plane, like clinging onto the sides for dear life. And it's about a kilometer from Papua New Guinea. Like, literally, you can like row across to Papua New Guinea. And landing there and getting greeted by these community members at the airport, just the most incredible, amazing people from the moment we met them. Just like a presence, incredibly physically conditioned, just like beautiful people. And these kids like crowded around us as soon as we got off the plane. They're like, you got to come meet Tala. Like Tala, like Tala's in the community. Like, come and meet Tala. We were like, you know, Tala must be an elder or something. Let's go meet Tala. And they kind of dragged us through this like salt scrub kind of bushes. And we came to this big kind of chicken wire fenced in puddle, really, it looked like. And they were like yelling, they're like, yeah, like meet Tala, like whatever. And one of them chucked a stick into this puddle. And the biggest saltwater crocodile I've ever seen, like I'm talking the jaws of saltwater crocodiles, just starts thrashing about in this puddle. We all scream and like back up, and I fell over backwards, and they were wetting themselves laughing at us.
You went from this sort of community work, Nick, to working in government, becoming a manager in the Victorian Department of Health. What sort of culture shock was government work after that?
It was so extreme. It was, and I don't even really know why they hired me. I think it was just like a wild card hire in there. But my first few days, I literally couldn't understand a word that anyone was saying. And I just remember this extreme urgency all the time. Everyone was always running about and always talking about like urgent briefings and this needs to be done. And really kind of going, and I think I still think like this actually, but you know, it's like a ministerial briefing. We need to get it up immediately. It's like, why don't you just go and talk to her? Like, why are we writing these things? And we got like 2 weeks to get them a briefing. But I was very fortunate to have a guy called Bill take me under his wing, because in my first couple of weeks there, I had like a management textbook and I would just read management words and just try to drop them in meetings to try to sound smart, like ring-fenced or supply and demand, like whatever, just try to sound like I knew what I was talking about. But Bill used to do this thing. He would sit in meetings, and he was a former mental health clinician, and so he was a real sector dude and he cared about making a difference. He would always be doing this complicated kind of maths in meetings. And then at the end of a meeting, he would go, right, we just achieved nothing and I've just done up your average salaries here and this meeting costs $1,000 of taxpayers' money and we achieved nothing. So next time, let's do better. I was like, yes, this is my kind of guy. And he really took me under his wing and kind of showed me the ways.
You went from that then to work with a new youth housing program called the FOIA. Why was that an organisation you wanted to get involved with? What was the FOIA?
Oh, it was so cool. So the Education First Youth FOIAs are this incredible initiative which totally rethink how we think about youth homelessness. So the whole idea was, if you can give young people a place to live in which over the time they live there, over a couple of years, they are a student, not a young person who's homeless, but a student on a space that is beautiful and respects them as people and co-located with TAFE. So they're like, you know, there on the grounds being a student and also connected to work, that while that's a more expensive model, it's a really fantastic way to transition people through into independent living. So the whole way we get this model funded is by saying our rate of stickiness of engaging in the program is so much greater than any other youth homelessness service that it's a worthwhile investment when you consider the avoided costs down the track and where most young people who experience homelessness head. And they were pulling together this kind of ragtag group of people to be involved in it because they didn't want people who'd been traditionally involved in the homelessness sector. And I remember meeting these like amazing, idealistic people, Professor Shelley Mellett from Melbourne University and Sally James at the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence at the time, who were talking about it, and their eyes were wide and they were like, this is going to change the game. Like, this is really going to make a difference and like be a part of something. And I was just like, yes, like this is what it's all about. This is going to be great.
So what was your role?
So I was the manager of that kind of flagship facility in Broadmeadows. And so we watched the whole place get built, this gorgeous multi-million dollar facility with 40 studio apartments, like gorgeous congregate spaces. And so I was to kind of hire the team and bring the team together and then get out there and just make it an awesome place to be, which could be two things. One, a great place for young people to live and study and work, but also be the kind of core piece in a campaign to make this nationally and internationally the approach that we take forward to youth homelessness.
And once the foyer was built and you were able to start working out who was going to be able to come and live in that space, when you'd meet with young people who were experiencing homelessness, needed somewhere to stay, what would you ask them?
It was wild. It was, so the very first question we asked, and this was super intentional, when young people came in, and they're coming in expecting, you know, a really deficit-based conversation. And the first question we would ask is, what are you good at? And like I've got goosebumps saying that because the response was so visceral from young people. So many of them had never been asked that ever in their lives. And some had been sleeping rough. Some had been in out-of-home care. And suddenly being asked, what am I good at?
What sort of things did they say?
It was such a range, you know, like so many couldn't pick something on the spot because they've never been asked the question. It's like a totally abstract question. Some of them would be like, I don't know, like I'm kind of good at, like good with my hands and I can make stuff. And then that's like an immediate in. It's like, great, well, let's make stuff. Like, let's get you making stuff. This is going to be awesome. And it was just such a brilliant thing because then when the young people met each other, the conversations they're having with each other are about their talents and the things they're good at too.
I imagine, Nick, that there's a lot of people's stories stay with you from that time. But tell me about a young couple you got to know. And I think the girl was only 16 when she started living at the foyer.
Yeah, a young one was 16 when she moved in. And just, you know, you meet people and they're just crackling with intellect, with intelligence. And as soon as I met her, I was like, whoa, this is like one of the smartest people I've ever met. And she had really struggled with some mental health challenges and also family challenges, which is how she had ended up in the foyer. But she moved in and was going to high school. And every day when I was showing up, and I would show up pretty early, I would show up at kind of 7, and there was this young man always who was sitting on the front step. And these two, and it was her boyfriend. And these two are like the most textbook handsome couple you've ever seen. They're like walking off the fashion pages, just like effortlessly cool. And he'd be waiting there. I'd be like, hey, man, like, what's going on? I'd be like, oh, I'm just waiting to see my girlfriend. I'd say, oh, like, you know, we can't have visitors until kind of 10 o'clock. He'd be like, well, I don't have anywhere else to go. And so he would just come and hang out in my office and we would just chat and we became really close over the course of a while. And we had a rule, which was people couldn't live with their partners at the foyer. But after a while, we ended up putting it to a vote to the foyer community of young people and saying, because he was like pretty much part of the community at that point. I was like, can we just have this young man stay with us? Because he's got nowhere else to go. And I had had lots of chats with his mom and, you know, home wasn't really an option at the time. And he did move in. And I just had this extraordinary relationship with these two young people. And I felt almost like they're kind of like, you know, semi-dad, you know, it was like amazing.
And how did that play out as time went on?
So after I finished up in my role there, I got a call a few weeks later that there had been some sort of incident, something to do with their plumbing in the room or something. But anyway, they had been kicked out. And I like didn't have any follow-up numbers for them. And the truth is, and this isn't really the done thing in the community sector, and I had a baby at home myself, but like I would have let them move in with me. Like I was, you know, which is, again, like not the done thing. But I really just saw the promise and the potential in these young people, but I couldn't get onto them. And I didn't hear from them again. I never heard anything. I would Google them all the time, never heard anything, put word out around the traps, never heard anything. And then it was the 10-year foyer anniversary a couple of years ago in 2024. And I was invited along as a guest. And I went along back out to Broadmeadows, back out to the space and walked in. And Beck, who had been, who was the manager at Now, but she had worked for me back in the day, said, oh, I've got someone I want you to see, come around here. And she took me around this corner and there they were. And sorry, it makes me really emotional, but they're still together. They own a house. They're both like have these amazing jobs. She's studying to be a psychologist, but also working in childcare. He was a chippy and has since kind of moved into the community sector. And they were just the same. And we just embraced in this moment. And it's been amazing getting to be a part of their lives again.
What were things like with your mum at this point when your little daughter was a new baby? What was going on with your mum?
So mum was at the time living with her best friend, or actually with her best friend's mum in a kind of spare bedroom there. And she would have patches where she was like great and like vibrant and awesome, and then patches where she was doing it really hard. And she'd had quite serious physical health issues with her hips, which were really hindered her ability to do work and really were kind of playing on her and certainly weren't good for her mental health. But it's interesting, Coco being born, my daughter being born, just like injected this real life and energy and sense of purpose into my mum. She was thrilled.
Were you still scared about her, worried for her, Nick, for your mum?
Absolutely, yeah. I there was a time when Coco was a baby actually where mum and I, and we really, really argue, like it's not the kind of relationship we have, but we had had sort of an argument over the phone and I was in Preston at the time, and she was living in Brighton. And I tried calling her back afterwards and I couldn't get onto her. Her phone was off, I think, or I was trying to call, I can't remember. But I just suddenly was convinced that she had tried to kill herself or had killed herself. I was totally convinced. And I asked Megan to drive me to Brighton, and Coco was in the back and Coco was crying. And I was like actually inconsolable. Like I was just howling the whole way there because I was so sure. I was sure that she was dead. I got to her house and went in and was going through it, and there was kind of, she wasn't there, and going through her stuff. And I remember Coco was on the ground crying. And then mum just kind of pulled in and just wandered in, and she was just there. And she's like, what's going on? Yeah, and looked down. I remember she just kind of scooped Coco up in her arms and was holding her. And I just didn't even know how to respond. It's like, oh, she's alive and she's right here and it's okay. But just that fear was really, really lodged in me.
You ended up going back to a job in the state government in 2020. How did your friends refer to you as you had this new gig?
They referred to me as the bureaucrapper. They took bureaucrat and rapper and jammed those words together and thought they were really funny.
They were right.
Yeah. There's a fair bit of truth in that title as well, I think.
What was involved with that job?
So I initially went in to work in higher education and skills, but shortly transitioned through into what was like pretty much my dream gig. So it's a real rarity in government to get a scenario where you can really make change and invest in change. But it was a period where I was in the Department of Education. The Deputy Premier at the time was also the Minister for Education, and Victoria was the education state. And the branch that I moved in to become the executive of was a branch that had everything for young people who are at risk. So it was like young people in out-of-home care, young people at risk of contact with youth justice, young people at risk of disengagement from school. So we held all these programs and all this policy, but also these amazing systems levers like attendance policy and expulsion policy and suspension policy, and somehow had this like, and this never happens in government, by the way, but this like group of like really dynamic, energetic, mission-focused people. And it was like being in a non-profit, but I'm in government and we've been given the green light to just like make great change and a budget. It was like, let's get after it and make a difference.
So did you feel like you were the right man for that job, the right person in the right place?
So I felt at the same time, both like I was the right person in the sense I had a great vision, but I was also just plagued by imposter syndrome and fear of failure. Like I would put on my shoulders the weight of like the fate of young people in Victoria who are at risk rests on my shoulders. And I would put absolutely down that like I genuinely believed I was super dumb and that I had somehow like talked my way into these jobs that I was in. and just decided, like, if I wasn't going to be the smartest person in any room, then I was going to be the hardest worker in every room I was in, because, like, I wanted to be kicking ass. Like, I wanted to be really making a difference tangibly, or I was wasting this opportunity.
Then along comes 2020 and the lockdowns in Melbourne during COVID. What did the lockdowns mean for the job that you were doing and the kids that you sort of had ultimate responsibility for, I guess?
Yeah, so attendance fell into our patch. And actually, it was funny, you know, this is like such a boring mechanical thing, but attendance coding is a big thing in schools. And I remember literally the previous November before COVID, sitting around with a guy who worked for me, and we were talking about attendance codes. So it's like why a young person is absent or why they attend. And he was like reading them out to me, and one of them was pandemic. I was like, oh, how ridiculous. What, is the Black Plague going to hit us or something? Get rid of it. Like, you know, how stupid.
It's people like you who brought that curse upon us, Nick.
Oh, it's just ridiculous. So when it came, I was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? And, you know, suddenly we went from this quite small percentage of young people being, you know, vulnerable or at risk. Suddenly every young person is at risk in the state, and every young person is schooling from home. And we need eyes on the child. That's why teachers play this important role in the safety and well-being of young people. And suddenly we couldn't do that in the same way. And the pressure to try to pivot and make sure that people are safe and well was just extraordinary.
What kind of hours were you putting in?
So for ages, I was doing, you know, 12 or 14-hour days, 6 or 7 days a week. But I was, like, so not getting on top of it. I was just drowning in work and trying to get resources and trying to get things done. And it just kept, and I was trying to protect my team, I think, trying to shield my team rather than kind of share the load in a meaningful way. I made this decision at one point. I was like, if I just stop sleeping for a few days, and I was running on adrenaline anyway, like I would wake up after a few hours sleep and my mind had already been working for 30 minutes. So if I can just stop sleeping for a few days, I'll just catch up and I'll get on top of things.
This is not the decision of someone in a good space,
no,
is it? I'll solve this by not sleeping.
Extraordinarily poor decision.
In how hindsight. Did it play out?
So for the first couple of days, it was like awesome because I was like starting to catch up on things. And then I had
How
this...
were you keeping yourself awake physically? I mean, was it just the adrenaline?
Just running on adrenaline, pure adrenaline. Like I remember shaking with it. And actually, I remember the smell of my sweat was like a chemical. And I found out later that that's cortisol, but it was just like this chemical stench was so strange. And I had like clumps of hair in my hands when I would shower as well. And on the third day, I think, or the fourth day, it's hard to remember, I had this eerie thing where I found all these sent emails in my sent box, and they were perfectly fine emails, beautifully constructed, perfectly reasonable. But I had no recollection of sending them. And some of them were sent at like 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning. And I also had this really eerie sense that I hadn't written them and started to worry that maybe like someone was writing emails for me. I couldn't work it out. And then probably the next day after that, I was chairing an executive meeting in government.
Over Zoom, I imagine.
Over
that
Zoom.
Era. Yeah.
Yeah. And I blinked during the meeting. And when my eyes opened, I was in my car. And I was driving at 130 kilometres an hour on the wrong side of the road. And where I live is, I live in Belgrave, so it's kind of bushy hill land outside of Melbourne. So it was between Belgrave and Callista. I was on this road. And just like, I just teleported there. I had no idea what I was doing there. I was shaking so violently. And, you know, if it weren't for the fact that it was locked out and there weren't cars on the road, I'd probably be dead and someone else probably would be as well.
So you pulled over? What did you do?
Pulled over, but it was a really hard spot to pull over because it's off one side it was a sheer kind of cliff drop down into the bush, and on the other side it's just like cliff face. It's a kind of a hill, a valley. And so I drove through it till there was a space I could pull over, a kind of dirt patch, and pulled over. And I was shaking so violently that I just couldn't even get the keys out of the ignition, couldn't do anything. But when I eventually managed to look at my phone and look at the time, hours had passed. And it felt unreal. Like I had no idea how I'd gotten there. And when eventually my hands stopped shaking enough to be able to drive again and try to get home, my legs were shaking so badly. I was driving along and just remember so clearly it was this huge It's like a dream catcher, like a huge, massive dream catcher that had been built in a tree just through that patch. Just like going, what is going on? Where am I? And it turns out someone had died there a couple of months earlier in a car accident, and someone had constructed this thing. But the whole thing was so strange. And I got home and called my boss, who was a lovely man, and just said, I just need some time. I need some time. And the shame was unbelievable.
Shame that you weren't meeting your responsibility, or what? How do you describe that shame? Why?
Yeah, I just felt like no one could care as much as I cared. And I was just stitching all these young people up by not following through and not finishing things. And it just felt like the ending I'd always been so scared of. You know, it was like I'd been running my whole career from, you know, feeling like a fake or feeling like I didn't know enough. And it was like, this is the answer I'd always been waiting for, which is you're not good enough or you're not strong enough.
What were the days and weeks like after that phone call with your boss?
It felt like I was like a fast-moving train that ran into just an enormous white pillow of nothing. And so I sat in this armchair, this kind of blue armchair in my house, and just stared at a wall for probably between 16 and 24 hours a day for maybe around a month. And on this wall, there was this picture that I'd taken of my daughter. I had like a nice camera and I'd taken a nice photo of her in the park probably like a year and a quarter earlier, and she was playing in the park. I was just staring at this picture and I couldn't even believe that was in the same lifetime. Like, it just felt like so long ago that something like that was possible. And I just, like I hated myself. Like, I just sat there just in this world of numbness and despair and was just kind of watching the world go past from this armchair.
How did that start to change?
I had this kind of moment of clarity at one point where I realized, and I was trying to journal and write things down, but it was all really convoluted. And I realized that now I had burned out, and now this outcome I'd always been so terrified of had occurred, that a whole lot of stuff didn't matter anymore. Like, being scared of failure, I really felt like I'd failed. It was like, well, okay, like, that's done. Now what? And, you know, this deep sense of imposter syndrome, it's like, well, you know, that doesn't matter anymore either. And there was something in understanding that and then listening to, I don't know if you know Neil Gaiman, the author, gave this great speech. He gave a commencement speech at a university that someone sent me who was worried about me and wanted me to listen to this thing. It was called Make Good Art. And as a part of this speech, he talked about when he was pursuing his career as a writer, how he imagined it as a mountain in the distance. And any decision he had to make would take him closer to that mountain or move him further away. I think I just had this realization that, like, my mountain has always been achievement at work or has been about something else. But, like, what might my mountain be now that I'm not doing this anymore? And starting to think about that started to feel like hope.
And so what started to take the place of work for you as the purpose and meaning?
My daughter was a really big part of it. So, and my daughter is like my mini-me in a bunch of ways. And she was like so scared for me during that time. And like, not that she had any idea what was going on, but I could just see it in her eyes. She never wanted me to leave the house after I finally got off the armchair. She was just kind of glued to me. And I just didn't want her to have that same sort of childhood that I had had at points where I was worried about my mum. And so thinking about her and also just thinking about, like, what does making a difference look like when it's not just about effort, when it is just about trying to do great stuff and looking after myself as part of that story and moving from all the bells and whistles of external validation and starting to think, like, what am I about? What's my internal validation look like? What does success look like for me on the inside?
And so what does work look like for you these days, Nick?
I'm enormously privileged nowadays to be able to coach and support people who are either at risk of or experiencing burnout, and to help organisations prevent burnout in their, especially non-profit organisations and government within their space. And it feels like such an amazing thing and sense of purpose to have had this really awful experience, but to now be able to parlay that into trying to help others not have the same thing or come to the same place and instead have this really rich and wonderful experience of work and of purpose and of making a difference, but in a way which isn't going to drastically impact their sense of self and their life.
And what about hip-hop? Has it still got a place in Nick Orchard's life?
It certainly does. And look, my love language with my daughter and my little brother is music, and they are both massive hip-hop fans. And I had the most beautiful moment just late last year where a really good friend of mine who was also a rapper and I, our daughters were born really close to each other, and we're all massive Kendrick Lamar fans. And we went to the Kendrick Lamar concert, and I had my arm around my friend Jeremy, and we're both rapping along every word, and look over, and our daughters are there with their arms around each other, rapping every word. And both of them are our mini-me's. Like, they look like both of us. And then both he and I are crying, watching our daughters, and they're just ripping along. It's like, it's such a beautiful thing.
Just lastly, I want to ask how your mum's doing these days.
My mum's great. My mum is fantastic. It's been just the most extraordinary turnaround for her. And it's interesting, she's found her space in the community as well. She runs amazing community classes with children and young people, which has always been her great passion. She looks after young people as well and has just, things have settled. And like the extremities of the kind of colour and that kind of lack of colour when she wasn't well, she's just always colourful, but not in a way that is like, that has those massive ups and massive lows anymore. And I'm just so grateful constantly that she's here and that I'm able to have the relationship with her that I have.
I'm guessing she's super proud of you.
I hope so. I hope so. I'm really proud of her for what she's done too.
Nick, it's been really lovely to meet you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanowski.
Nick Orchard was my guest on Conversations today, and this story was produced by Alice Moldovan. And of course, if you ever need to talk to someone, then Lifeline is always there. Their phone number is 13 11 14. The executive producer of Conversations is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanowski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanowski. For more Conversations episodes, head to ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.